Welcome, and thank you for joining me for Ghosts of Arlington, Episode 29, Red-Blooded American in the Red Army, the true story of Joseph Byerly, the only soldier to fight for both America and the Soviet Union in World War II, Part 3. When we last left Sergeant Jumpin' Joe Byerly, he had been a German prisoner of war for about a month, having been captured, escaped, and captured a second time in Normandy, all in the span of a few days. He was then moved farther away from the fighting, had an encounter with the Desert Fox, German Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, and survived heavy Allied air attacks and several psychologically brutal rounds of interrogation before the Germans decided he was a soldier who couldn't be broken. The questioning lasted several days, where he was not fed and only given the bare minimum to drink. After the final session, he took a rifle butt to the head, fracturing his skull, putting him into a 6-day coma, and it would take a week before he could actually remember anything. While all this was going on, the Byerly family was listening to every news report they could about the invasion of France and ongoing combat operations around the world. The war had already been rough on the Michigan family. Joe's two older brothers, the ones who had dropped out of high school to join the Civilian Conservation Corps to help the family financially during the Depression, had also joined the military after Pearl Harbor. John was wounded in New Guinea and would eventually receive a medical discharge. Bill was in the Air Corps stationed in England and flying dangerous missions over Europe. Robert and Richard, the two youngest sons, were anxiously waiting to see if the war would end before they turned 17, the newly lowered draft eligibility age. Army Chief of Staff General George Marshall regularly submitted a list of Americans killed in the previous 24 hours to President Roosevelt. These lists were subsequently printed in newspapers coast to coast. By the end of the war, nearly 300,000 names would appear on Marshall's lists. When post-D-Day mail began arriving in Muskegon, there was nothing from Joe. Then a telegram arrived from the War Department on July 7th, a full month after the invasion. When it arrived, Mrs. Byerly couldn't open it and had to ask her son Robert to. In typical teenage fashion, Robert read the notice, handed it to his mother, and said, "Joe's a prisoner of war, Mom," like it was no big deal. Mrs. Byerly had to read the telegram several times herself before calling her husband at work with the news. Then in September, another telegram arrived with a crushing correction. Sergeant Joseph Robert Byerly, serial number 16085985, previously reported captured on 10 June 1944, had instead, on that date, been killed in action. Mrs. Byerly, whose health had weakened since Pearl Harbor, was bedridden for several days. Of course, we know that Joe wasn't killed in action, so how did the War Department come to that conclusion? Well, after Joe's escape following his initial capture, you may recall that one of his fellow escapees, Captain Robert Harwick, made it back to friendly lines and reported on Joe's first capture. It wasn't clear why Byerly was reported as a prisoner of war at this time. Since his last known status was an escapee trying to get back to U.S. lines, he should have been classified as missing in action. It is possible that an escapee from Starvation Hill could have confirmed that Joe was again a prisoner, but we only know of Harwick's report for sure. but why was he now reported killed in action? Throughout the summer, Allied forces continued pushing east from the sea, eventually making it out of Normandy and the Cotentin Peninsula altogether. This is when the Graves registration personnel we talked about back in episode 11 came ashore and began collecting, identifying, burying, and registering soldiers killed in action. One of these broken bodies, shattered by heavy caliber fire and wearing an American uniform, had Joe's dog tags around his neck. Remember the German who snatched Joe's dog tags off his neck last week? It seems as though he was hoping to create some mischief of his own. The Catholic community in Muskegon was ethnically diverse, each with its own parish and school. Irish, Italian, French, and German, the last being the smallest. They united to console the family. Word about the second telegram spread quickly, and visitors from all over, many of whom the family had never met, came to grieve with them. The most remembered and treasured words came from the sisters who had taught Joe at St. Joseph High School. They told stories the family had never heard, and Mrs. Byerly asked each sister for more until the memories were completely exhausted. To continue talking about Joe seemed to keep him alive, if just for a little while. Joe's funeral mass was held on September 17, 1944, exactly 1 year to the day after he'd arrived in England. St. Joseph's Church overflowed. In the homily, the priest spoke of how there are words like orphan and widow for the bereaved, but no name for the parent who has lost a child. It wasn't meant for children to die first, but in war they do, and that must be accepted. Each note of taps seemed a tug to let go, acknowledge he was gone, but Mrs. Byerly clung to Sister Angelique, Joe's mother superior at school's scriptural reading at the Mass. Though he were dead, yet shall he live. She didn't know how right she was. On October 23rd, Mr. Byerly got a phone call at work. A Major Reedy identified himself and advised that a message had been received from the International Red Cross. The Germans confirmed that Joseph Robert Byerly was indeed alive and a prisoner of war, but if you'll recall, he also had a fractured skull. In his book, The Simple Sounds of Freedom, Thomas H. Taylor writes, "Unconquered but unconscienced, Joe presented something of a problem for the interrogators. There on the floor, bleeding slightly from the nose and ears, was a low-ranking prisoner about to die. He had a previous wound, but it could hardly be blamed for his death. To avoid an investigation, the interrogators moved him to medical channels at once, perhaps citing serious infection of his previous wound as the reason. They no doubt hoped that hobnailed boot prints on his torso would go unnoticed in a German field hospital, rife with horrific wounds. Joe had been kicked viciously while he was down, while he was comatose. Permanent damage resulted from scar tissue that pressures the top of the sciatic nerve. For the rest of his life, the nerve pressure would cause him to sporadically black out. The skull fracture remains sensitive to barometric changes, especially with high humidity. Joe drifted in and out of consciousness for about a week. He remembered seeing things that made him think he was in the afterlife, but transitioned back to reality when he focused on two figures in white hovering over him, talking about him. It was then he knew he wasn't in heaven because, quote, "angels don't speak German," end quote. The beings were really a doctor and a nurse. After getting some pain medication, Byerly was returned to where he had been housed for his interrogations, but the Allied advance continued east and the prisoners were moved farther from the front. In August 1944, American infantry marched in triumph down the Champs-Élysées in Paris, which became one of the most photographed and famous events of the war. Earlier that month, American prisoners were taken to Paris and paraded along the same route for Nazi propaganda cameras, obviously shot to convince French collaborators that the Americans were a contemptible presence in Europe and Germans in the fatherland that these so-called soldiers would not be able to stand up to the valor and discipline of the Wehrmacht. Loudspeakers declared the miserable group to be murderers and rapists paroled from U.S. prisons to attack Franco-German civilization. French collaborators took up a chorus of hisses and jeers. They began to throw garbage at the POWs shuffling by, some of whom were so hungry they caught and ate it. Following the propaganda episode, the prisoners were crammed into overloaded boxcars for the long, hot, cramped final leg of the journey to a POW camp in Germany. Just a few days into the journey, American fighters strafed the train, destroying the locomotive, but also sending 50 caliber machine gun bullets into the nearest two or three cars, including Byerly's. The boxcar roofs had not been marked as POW transport by the Germans, in case the Allies decided to try to liberate their comrades. By the time they arrived at the camp, a few dozen prisoners were dead, either killed in the initial air raid or dying of their wounds in transit. When they finally arrived in Germany, the prisoners ignored their captors' orders to form ranks and instead respectfully removed the wounded from the boxcar first and then the dead. Only then did they dismount themselves. It was the first time they had been allowed out of the car since embarking in Paris a week earlier. The first permanent prisoner of war camp Byerly arrived at was Stalag 12A. It was just one camp in a prison archipelago created 5 years earlier when Hitler had invaded Poland. From now on, these POWs would be known as Kriegs, short for the German word for prisoners of war, Kriegsgefangene. Unlike concentration camps run by the plainclothes branch of the SS, Stalags were run by the Wehrmacht or Luftwaffe, and after the summer of 1944, when the war began turning against the Germans' favor, treatment of prisoners greatly improved compared to the early days of the war. Unlike their experience in France, Kriegs might never again be interrogated unless their actions ran afoul of camp rules. Per the Geneva Convention, those with the rank of sergeant and above weren't even made to do manual labor. Of course, none of this applied to Russian prisoners captured on the brutal Eastern Front who were routinely executed or rounded up inside barbed wire enclosures and left to starve to death or otherwise die in the elements. Stalag 12A was large. Its population fluctuated between 5 and 10,000 Kriegs at any given time. Upon arrival, prisoners were deloused, showered, shaved, their uniforms laundered, and then they were allowed to sleep for nearly 12 hours. That was followed by processing where they would be registered, photographed, vaccinated, and given a POW number stamped on a dog tag. Prisoners were then required to write a letter home, censored, of course. If the letter failed to pass the censors twice, no letter would be sent home, so Joe didn't mention any of the wounds he had received, especially those inflicted by the Germans. This letter arrived in Michigan just days after the Byerlys were informed their son and brother was actually alive. Life in the camp was dull. There was plenty of time to contemplate the failure of one's wartime existence that led to being captured. Joe kept thinking about all the good he could be doing fighting to liberate Europe instead of sitting around in need of liberation himself. And hunger was a constant companion. They were fed, but it was never enough, and many thought of nothing more than when their next meal would arrive. About a month after arriving in Stalag 12A, he was transferred to a new camp, Stalag 4B. Tired of feeling sorry for himself and now more or less fully healed of his fractured skull, Byerly decided the best thing he could do for himself was to get back into shape. After its initial treatment, his butt wound had become infected, and a British doctor was able to clean it up and remove the last bits of shrapnel, which Joe kept for the rest of his life. From what Joe was told, Stalag 4B was the original POW camp built by the Germans. Even if it wasn't, it was just south of Berlin, so it was well organized and well maintained. Americans were new to Stalag 4B, where some British, Canadian, Australian, French, and Dutch soldiers had been for years. The most memorable event for Byerly in Stalag 4B was his 21st birthday, celebrated with a sugared lump of dough baked on the hut stove, a cigarette for a candle. As Joe wasn't a smoker, he was able to trade the cigarette for something he could use. In time, Joe was transferred yet again. One reason for the constant transfers was that it helped break up possible escape schemes. Joe had come to the attention of the Underground Escape Committee run by the British, and while he had been identified by them as a possible escape candidate, nothing solid had been planned before he was moved. Byerly's most important lesson from Stalag 4B came by way of two U.S. Rangers who had joined the Canadian Army before Pearl Harbor and had been captured as Canadians in mid-1942. The fundamentals they taught him helped him survive his time in captivity. Quote, "Save some food from every meal, no matter how much is available from the International Red Cross or won by gambling. Tomorrow there could be none. Don't expect to learn about a successful escape. The Krauts won't admit to it, and the escape committee doesn't want to be flooded with proposals. No matter how tired you are, exercise. The energy you put out actually adds to your overall strength, even when it tires you out. Like stashed food, you'll need that deep strength when you get sick, as everyone does sooner or later. Exercise makes it later. If your legs swell, it means you may be getting beriberi, so trade for anything that has protein." The senior prisoner of war at a camp has a net of informers, so be careful about what you say and to whom. It could be worse to be on the bad side of the senior POW in camp than to piss off the Krauts, sort of like the choice between being fingered by the police or the mafia. The senior POW's enforcers can get to you in ways the cops can't. End quote. Joe would take these lessons with him when he was moved to a third camp, Stalag 3C, on September 17, 1944, the same day as his funeral back home, and the same day the Screaming Eagles had their second combat jump. This one as part of Operation Market Garden, the failed plan to liberate the Netherlands. When news of the Allied jump into the Netherlands first reached the Kriegs, they were sure they would be liberated in no time. Joe's initial enthusiasm faded when the homemade compass he had with him on the train showed he was heading east, farther from the American troops. When it stopped, he found himself in the middle of Polish farmland, which turned out to be a good thing as local potatoes fed the prisoners. It was getting harder and harder to ship food to camps inside Germany. Byerly was one of the first Americans transferred to Stalag 3C. As POWs were captured first during Market Garden and then the Battle of the Bulge, the number of Americans grew to about 2,000. An unknown number of Russian prisoners taken on the Eastern Front made up the other half of the camp and were strictly segregated from the Americans. It was in Stalag 3C that Byerly finally made contact with a camp escape committee. No one had ever escaped from this camp, and there were some inherent difficulties associated with an escape. Principally that being in Poland, an escapee would have to cross all of Germany to reach American forces. Because of this, all of the initial escape proposals were turned down and the escape committee went dormant for a while, but Joe never stopped thinking about escape. In time, Joe identified two men, Brewer and Quinn, who looked like good escape companions, who turned out to be ready to try to run off with him if he came up with a viable plan. Returning to Simple Sounds of Freedom, Thomas H. Taylor writes, "One of the first essentials for an escape was getting to know the Germans and their routines. The guard shifts were 8 hours, one of which was at night when Kriegs couldn't leave their huts, but shifts rotated, so if Joe wanted to focus on a particular guard, he could talk with him every couple of days. Starting a conversation was no problem. Guards liked to practice English. Word was that several were planning their own escape to get away from the Red Army and be captured by the Americans. Another good idea was to get the lay of the land outside the camp, so Byerly volunteered for work details that would take him into the surrounding countryside. This went well until the work detail was caught trying to liberate some potatoes for personal use. This wasn't rare behavior and was usually punished with light beatings, but on this day the senior guard gave the order to open fire. One prisoner was killed and Byerly was shot through the shoulder. Fortunately, the round passed through without striking bone, but the impact was harder than the shell fragment he caught in Normandy had been. His arm went so numb that he initially thought it had been blown off. When he did feel it again, he described the pain as flame dissolving ice. Anyone who had been wounded was being drug away by the Germans and put into solitary confinement, which turned out to be a death sentence to at least one POW. Seeing this, Joe quickly packed the wound with dirt to stop the bleeding, and then painstakingly made his way back to his hut, where a Krieg medic came by to patch him up in secret. After that, he stopped volunteering for work details. In time, the shoulder healed, but it was never quite the same. When he stopped going out on work details, Byerly had a lot of free time and started getting into the daily craps games. The bets were made with cigarettes that would come in with Red Cross packages, and one day Joe got hot. When all was said and done, he had won 70 packs of smokes, a veritable fortune, and the three would-be escapees found themselves with enough cigarettes to bribe the right people to escape. It was time to take their plan to the committee. Winter was closing in, so if an escape was to be attempted, it would have to be soon, likely a moonless or near-moonless night in early November. Byerly and his two compatriots, Brewer and Quinn, had their plan approved by the escape committee and a guard was paid in smokes to look the other way while a hole was cut in the barbed wire. Once that guard shift was over, he didn't want to get in trouble for being the one on duty when the escape happened. The three prisoners slipped out of camp and made it to nearby woods where they would hide until jumping onto a passing train. The major problem was that no one knew where the train's final destination was. The spot they waited at was along a rise in the railroad track, so when the train did come along, it was only moving at the speed of a fast walk. The boxcar they jumped in was full of grain, no doubt to feed horses. This seemed to confirm their hope that they were now headed towards the Eastern Front, toward Russian allies who might be able to get them back to U.S. forces. But it was not to be. The car they were hiding in was detached, hooked up to a different locomotive, and when they started moving again, this time they were headed southwest. When they finally stopped, they were in Berlin. Not exactly a good place for American escaped POWs to be in 1944. The three were kicking themselves. They could have hopped onto flat cars with tanks that were surely headed to the Eastern Front. They had assumed the entire train had the same destination. Now their situation couldn't be worse. They were in the center of Hitler's Reich, at maximum distance from friendly forces, with huge German armies to get through in either direction. There was no movement in the massive rail yard for a few days, no trains in or out, and no people. After 2 or 3 days of looking around and trying to figure out their next move, they spied a lone German checking the cars. After some debate, Byerly approached the man and tried to buy some help, or at the very least, food and water. After 3 or 4 days on the run, the escapees had used up the meager rations they had been able to bring with them. The man returned the next day with a horse and cart and took the three to a house where they hid in a basement and were given a little sustenance. The men were hopeful they would be able to sneak out of Berlin now, but 8 goons with flashlights entered the basement and began beating the Americans. When the paratroopers put up a fight, including stabbing one of their attackers with a shiv, the beatings grew worse and was only stopped when the POWs began lapsing in and out of consciousness. They had been betrayed to the Gestapo. Now Joe had another unique distinction for his unorthodox military career. His escape group was likely the only 3 American infantrymen captured in Berlin during the war. They were taken to Gestapo headquarters on Prince Albrechtstrasse and separated, each led to their own cell. The Gestapo didn't interrogate Joe as his previous captors did. They just tortured him, trying to get him to confess to being a spy who parachuted in with the goal of directing American and British bombers to targets. Looking back on the experience, Byerly said, "Sometimes I heard myself scream. Other times I was sort of watching myself scream. Many times I was that scream. My mugshot from 12A shows me glowering. They knew I was tough and stubborn. They were looking for a weakness, something like my shoulder wound. I was stripped so they could see how I was healing. They reopened the wound and probed around. And they had a favorite shoulder torture. They hung me up backwards, hoisted and dropped me until the shoulders dislocated. Releasing the ropes brought equal pain in reverse. The combination blacked me out for the first time. When that happened, I heard other voices screaming like mine. Most were in German, but also other languages. Whether it was my imagination or other cells I heard, it was a chorus begging, calling out to God. The walls absorbed it. From then on, I must have been screaming in and out of consciousness. They were good at noticing that, bringing you up to passing out, then backing off a little to bring you back up again. When I thought they could do no more, they always found other ways. They were in no hurry because what were hours for me were just minutes for them. I felt exactly what they were doing. Felt it, but at the same time watched. It was a terrible zone. That's the endpoint of terror. You don't get through it, you survive it, or you don't. And if you do, you wish you hadn't. I was witnessing while having my body twisted and destroyed. It was burning and freezing at the same time. I was broken down into coals. I survived but was never made whole, and I was one of their luckiest prisoners. In between torture sessions, Byerly was shackled to the wall of his cell, somewhere between a kneeling and standing position. After 4 days, he prayed for death and hoped it would be quick. Instead, he was moved to a bigger cell with 3 chairs. Brewer and Quinn were already seated in 2 of them, their beaten faces swollen to the size of basketballs. Joe figured this was it, one last opportunity to confess to trumped-up charges or a bullet to the head. Maybe both. Probably both. Through swollen eyes, he saw Wehrmacht soldiers enter the room with submachine guns. He glanced at his buddies, tried to smile, and mumbled something about how nice it was that they raided an entire firing squad. While a muted conversation took place between the black-uniformed Gestapo and the green-uniformed Wehrmacht, he tried to come up with some good last words in German to show his captors that while they had broken him physically, they had not broken him mentally. He was ready to die with his head held high. The exchange between the Gestapo and the Wehrmacht grew heated, and Joe realized that the Wehrmacht lieutenant colonel was demanding that the prisoners, who he acknowledged as escaped POWs and not spies, be turned over to him. When the black shirts insulted the colonel's ability to defend the fatherland, he had received a serious wound on the Eastern Front and had a severe limp as a result. The officer drew his Luger, and the 2 other green shirts pointed their submachine guns at the unarmed Gestapo. The Wehrmacht had won. The prisoners were loaded into the back of a staff car and driven away. The soldiers knew the POWs were escapees, but not from which Stalag. Not seeing any harm in it, the Americans admitted it was from Stalag 3C when asked, and to 3C they were returned. Though it had started out well, the escape had been a poor attempt with luck and judgment against them, but they had survived their time with the Gestapo, and few Gestapo captives lived to say that. After being returned to the camp and 15 days of solitary confinement as a punishment, Byerly, Brewer, and Quinn were released back into the general American POW population. The three had been away from the camp for 2 weeks before returning, so it was late November when they returned to the general population. Morale was high as BBC news was smuggled in about Allied success following the debacle of Market Garden, but that evaporated before Christmas when they started seeing dozens and dozens of new American prisoners arrive in the camp, captured during the Battle of the Bulge. Joe had had little contact with Brewer and Quinn after their release from solitary. It was dangerous for the conspirators to be seen together, but eventually they found ways for clandestine communication, and one thing was clear: they each wanted another shot at escape. This second plot would have to be done without the knowledge of the escape committee, who they knew wouldn't support a second attempt by the same group. The first thing they did was decide that this time the escape would be do or die. They would not allow themselves to be captured and tortured again. After coming to this conclusion, there was less anxiety about the escape than there had been while planning the previous attempt. The trio reached out to a few trusted Kriegs to help cause a diversion, but only one was willing to help. He told them if they were crazy enough to try it again, he would do what he could to help them on their way. This Krieg, known only as Weasel, agreed to create a diversion by starting a fight much larger than the minor scuffles that would occasionally break out among men living in cramped conditions for a long period of time. There were two Kriegs who always went around bullying the others, and Weasel was a popular target for them. Even though he was sure to be punished and likely to get a beating before it could be broken up, he was willing to attack these two. In January 1945, the second escape plan was put in motion. It was an absolutely crazy plan. First, Brewer, who normally walked around the exercise yard, started jogging and was hooting, hollering, and sounding really upbeat so that people would notice him. Then he pulled the old, "I'm having chest pains" routine so Byerly and Quinn could come to his aid, put him on a stretcher, and get permission to take him to the camp infirmary on the German side of the fence. Before reaching the infirmary, the three slipped unnoticed into a crawl space. They were unnoticed because about that same time, Weasel started his promised fight. The escapees couldn't see it, but they could hear it, and it sounded like the biggest brawl the Stalag had ever seen. It was late afternoon, nearly dark, when all the guards converged on the fracas and were content to watch it a while before trying to break it up. That's when the boys left the crawl space. Every Tuesday and Friday, a local Polish farmer came to deliver 3 barrels of vegetables to the camp, and the three escapees slipped into the 3 now empty barrels in the back of the farmer's wagon. Now it seemed the farmer, who had been watching the fight, decided things might get out of hand, returned to the cart, and started off with much greater speed than usual. They barely made it outside the camp before the jostling of the cart caused the barrels to spill out into a ditch. The farmer hollered when he saw the POWs and a nearby watchtower opened up with rifle and machine gun fire. The three men were up and running, zigzagging toward the woods. Bullets struck Brewer on Joe's left and Quinn on his right. Byerly didn't think either wound would be fatal, and the three had agreed beforehand that if anyone was shot in the attempt, the others would keep moving. He made it to the woods and didn't stop. He found a barn with hay for warmth and a little food, too. He spent the next week in near constant movement, avoiding people and towns at all costs, covering nearly 30 miles in the process. That's when he heard it. Artillery. Big thundering volleys off to the east. It had to mean the Russians, didn't it? Well, we'll have to wait until next time to find out if Joe is able to make it to Allied lines or if he is caught for a fourth time by the Germans. Though I suspect the title of these last few episodes might give you a clue as to the end result. I say next time and not next week because I'm going to have to take next week off. I know, I just took 2 weeks at the end of the year, but when one gets the chance to head to Florida in January, one should always do just that. I expect to be out for just 1 week, though, and when I get back, we will finish the story of Joe Byerly. If you need more Ghosts of Arlington content in your life, there are photographs and additional information about every episode on the website, www.ghostsofarlingtonpodcast.com. Ghosts of Arlington is also on Facebook and Twitter, and links to those sites are in the show notes. As always, I encourage you to leave a review and 5-star rating on iTunes or wherever you stream the show, as that helps others find the podcast. If you really want to make my day, refer the show to a friend. And remember, fear not death, for the sooner we die, the longer we shall be immortal.